Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. Today, Bob and I are talking about fighting the good fight, providing soldiers and veterans access to cannabis. And we are joined by the CEO of Hellman Valley Growers Company, Brian Buckley. Brian, thank you for taking some time to be here with us this afternoon.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you for having me on.
Before we jump in to this conversation, because we've seen some headlines, we know that there is a lot going on at the federal level, some conversations around veterans' use and cannabis and PTSD studies. I want to get a little bit of information from you and some background on your time as a Marine Raider. Tell us what that means. Tell us, if you can, what some of those experiences were like that really informed your leadership ability now as the CEO of HVGC.
Yeah, I really, had a great opportunity. First I started off in the Marine Infantry and did a deployment to Iraq. When I came back, they had me try out for Marine Reconnaissance. I made that, went right back to Iraq. And then when I came back from that, we were standing up our Marine Special Operations side, or Marine Raiders, to join Special Operations Command, which was, you have your Navy SEALs, your Army Green Berets, and people of that nature. So it was a pretty exciting thing to do, being a team commander. It wasn't so much like you just, but you go to a battlefield or you go out to combat like you do in Iraq or Afghanistan. There was a lot of things where I tell people I could be in a business suit working in an embassy to everything with a full battle rattle on, conducting a raid on high value individuals and everything in between. And it really was, learning how to be comfortable being uncomfortable and operating in an austere environment and being a critical thinker. And honestly, I don't know, there's much more you could use to help you succeed in cannabis than, operating in an austere environment, being comfortable, being uncomfortable, and being a critical thinker. So it's really kind of, I think, helped us. I always tell people in cannabis, you're essentially playing a game as they're making up the rules. So you got to be flexible and adjust, adapt, and overcome. And those are some of the things I definitely took from the military that I apply now.
No, I like that analogy. And it's like building a plane while you're flying it, or building a car while you're driving it kind of idea. But I like that quite a bit. But given the fact that so many military veterans such as yourself, you come back into civilian life and things are not just the same, or at least your perspective has changed for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is some of the experiences that folks have had abroad and otherwise. And, that can cause a lot of trauma. But also, there's injuries and the like. I'm sort of preaching to the choir here on those items. But I guess my point is, we've seen that, cannabinoids have been very helpful for people that suffer from things like PTSD and other, psychological disorders and the like, and not to limit it to CBD, but including THC. So take us on a little bit of the journey in your interactions with the VA in that respect, because their policy has evolved, although evolution's a bit of a misstatement when you talk about the federal government.
Yeah, it's been really interesting with the VA. First, I always tell people, I am a fan of the VA. I think the VA is doing the best that they can with what they have, but they are a federal agency, and unfortunately, cannabis remains a Schedule I narcotic, so there's really not much they can do. And obviously, we saw this past week where the VA cannabis research bill was shot down, essentially by the Attorney General, working with the Biden administration. I know some people were surprised. I really wasn't. But talking off the record with some VA doctors, they will say, they understand that we're getting ready to launch our research and they're wishing us the best of luck, because they're like, all we have is really these opiates and what else they give us. And we know this isn't answering the bill, but it's all that we have. So we really hope this works and we could put another tool in our toolkit to help out our veterans.
Well, and Brian, tell us about that study, because in conjunction with the work that you do for HVGC, you are also part of the Battle Brothers Foundation, is my understanding. And just give us some background on this observational study that you guys are moving forward with in this realm of medical cannabis use.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We were awarded an institutional review board, or an IRB, in February. We're just finalizing our funding to start the research. But, when I had an opportunity to talk with some members of the United States Congress, back in 2016, I asked them what would be needed in order to get medical cannabis into the VA system. And they said, if you can get data and get American doctors, you're going to have a good argument. So through that, we've partnered with a firm out of Israel called Niomedic Healthcare and Research Services. They've been operating for about 2 decades now. And we also were able to bring on University of California at Irvine and their medical side, and they will be the principal investigator. And we'll be running the research with 60 veterans out of UC Irvine. And it's more or less to see, you know, what cannabis is working. Is it helping to reduce the stress, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress? And from there, we'll kind of have an idea of what terpenes and cannabinoids are working the best. And then we'll look to more or less develop a formulation from there. And we'll take it further with a second study here in California with about 200 to 300 veterans. And then we'd like to move it into a second state using the same formulation, and that shows little to no deviation. And then at that point, we feel pretty confident we can go back in front of Congress and raise our right hands and saying, here's your data, here's your American doctors. Can we now proceed with FDA trials? So and it's exciting, too, because it's a private IRP. So we're not working with the National Institute of Drug Abuse or NIDA program out of the University of Mississippi, which if people know about that, you just hear how the cannabis probably isn't stored very well. It comes out very moldy, low THC, and just a not good product. And it's really not bearing much fruit from it. So we really feel with our stuff working with a private IRB and us having control of it, we could really make a difference and prove what medical cannabis can do. Because the great thing is the Israelis essentially have already done it. They've published in PubMed and they're showing it works. So now we just want to replicate it and push it forward with our government.
No, that's really well described. You know, the other thing about NIDA that maybe many of our listeners don't know is because marijuana is a Schedule I substance, as you point out, NIDA's charge, its mandate, is to identify reasons to support that classification, not to identify reasons where it might otherwise have a therapeutic benefit or otherwise. So despite that poor quality, as you describe, there's also not much science and research that comes out of that institution that provides beneficial analysis of how cannabinoids can assist the human body or work with the human body, although that has been loosening by virtue of the Department of Justice moving forward with authorizing some folks to do that, or at least considering the same. But I want to go back to the VA thing for a second, just because it's stuck in my head. We talked about, you know, the VA's position that, you know, Schedule I substance, our hands are tied. But what about CBD? What about non-intoxicating cannabinoids or any hemp derivatives? One thing is clear is that hemp is not a controlled substance, nor are its derivatives. With that said, you and I both know that the FDA does not yet regulate cannabinoids from hemp in terms of, you know, how they're going to be treated and so forth and so on. So can you articulate what's the VA's position on that? It's legal. It's just not regulated. And the lack of regulation doesn't make something illegal. It certainly doesn't render it a controlled substance.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And from the little talks I've had in terms of the CBD side of the house, you know, it kind of goes back to that catch 22 where they say, well, there's just not enough research on it. We don't know if it does work, if it is effective. And, you know, you're kind of like, well, how do we get more research? And they just kind of look at you like, well, I don't know. So I think until really the FDA kind of gets on board and starts moving things, I don't think any medical doctor is really going to come out and start prescribing it, especially the VA. So it's just kind of one of those weird kind of limbo universes, if you will, where we all know what it does. We know that it's fine. And, you know, you just kind of need to get the FDA and everything on track to get that stuff moving.
Well, and you brought up that you're working with a, sounds like a pretty established firm out of Israel. And, you know, when we spoke the other day, you said you have confidence in this research that you're undertaking because we kind of already know what the answer is. And we've had Saul Kay, we've had a couple of folks from Israel who have talked about on the show all the advancements that are going on in that country around cannabis research. So tell us a little bit, just in your own words, what your optimism is around what these studies will produce, because you kind of already know what the findings are going to be, just given that this isn't really inventing the wheel for the first time. This is just solidifying some American research that you probably kind of have a crystal ball as far as what you're going to find based off of some findings and studies that have been done over in Israel.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we are feeling pretty confident about it, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but you know, the medical staff at NIAMedic and Dr. Victor Novak, who's going to be leading our research. I mean, they're like, you know, we're doing this. We've already done it. I've been on calls with them with some high up government officials where they're like, can you prove that this works? And they're like, yes, here's our link to PubMed. Check it out. So we're feeling really good about it. And, you know, it's just kind of exciting, and we'll just kind of do our due diligence, make sure we're dotting our I's and crossing our T's so you can't punch too many holes at it. But again, numbers don't lie. And when we start producing the data and we're showing the positive effects that's having with the veterans to reduce the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and then we move it into another state and we show the little to no deviation and that this is repeatable and accessible, you know, at that point, we're like, you know, what is holding you back now? And kind of some of the frustrating part, I would say, for all of us is the United States of America has actually funded some of this research in Israel for them to do cannabis research. So again, you're kind of like, is this really happening? But, you know, right now I know cannabis, I kind of look at it as a infinite game, but we're playing in a finite arena. And this is the arena that we're in. So we're going to play the rules and we're going to do what we have to do and try to make a difference and break this glass ceiling.
In this study, is there a preferred or baseline method of delivery of the cannabinoids for purposes of proving it? Because, you know, delivery mechanisms matter in terms of, you know, how the body absorbs the cannabinoids, how it interacts with them, so forth and so on. Is there a preferred method or a methodology around delivery system in that study, if you're aware?
Yeah, fantastic question. So we were kind of thinking, you know, could we do it via a vape pen? Or something of that nature. But the thing with that stuff is there's no clinical trials behind them with dosing and all that. So what we are looking at is either it will be tincture or a pill form that would be provided to the veteran. And those have been clinically proven to work. And obviously people have probably received pills from the doctor or a tincture from a doctor. So that's most likely the delivery method that we're looking at will supply the medicine to the veteran.
Thanks for clarifying that. And I want to switch gears a little bit because a couple of weeks ago, we had Graham Farrar on the podcast. We talked a little bit about the California cannabis industry, some of the nuances, the legacy there, the storied history. And I know that you are also based in California. And I wanted to talk about, there's a number of topics we could cover, but let's talk for a moment about the California legislature's approval for $100 million to seemingly stimulate the legal industry in California, help alleviate some of the challenges we've seen with the legacy of the black market. So where do you kind of fall on all of this, Brian? What are your thoughts on how everything is shaking out with cannabis commercialization, let's say, in the Golden State?
Yeah, one, I really appreciate what our, the Congress here in California has done in order to pass the $100 million bill and get it out. That shows, you know, they are committed to making this program work in California. However, you know, if you really deep dive and you start looking at what's holding us up and why they think this $100 million could help out, and they think it could help people go through the CEQA process a little bit more quick, but I just don't really see it. I mean, you have a very in-depth CEQA and environmental impact reports that you would have to go through. It normally would take 30 to 45 days. We're seeing it take up to 12 to 18 weeks for a CEQA. Environmental information report could take up to a year. And now you literally have people who are sitting on property paying either a mortgage or rent on it, and they're not able to make any revenue. So they're burning money on that side. And then you have the high taxation that you have here in California. And we stack our taxes compared from seed to consumer. That same product that will just go to one person is getting taxed numerous times down the line. And that's where you're seeing the high tax burden come down on the consumer. And this is all kind of feeding in to the illicit market, where you got to jump through a lot of barriers of entry just to get up and operational. And then once you do, you have to pay these wildly high taxes, which are just killing your margins. And people are thinking, well, what's the advantage of going over there if we're really not even having people come after us in terms of the illicit market? I mean, sometimes, yeah, you hear about an illicit market shop getting shut down or whatnot, but it's not that often. And I would rather then take that $100 million, you know, go hire Elliot Ness and the Untouchables and go take down the illicit market, lower regulations, lower taxes. You're going to invite more people in to come from the gray market into the legal market. They'll participate by paying taxes, and you'll really see this program blossom. You know, play it like a more of a volume play, not just trying to, you know, kind of just had these ones and twos and threes out there, because I think they're anticipating 6,000 dispensaries. And I think right now we're sitting around 1,300 dispensaries, just due how long the licensing process takes and the high taxes. So I think good, you know, motivation, but I think poor execution. And again, I'll just go back to lower taxes, lower regulations, and you're going to really see this program take off here.
Well, there's been a lot of challenges in the California market, and I like your description of hiring Elliot Ness and you know, putting it out. Is enforcement of the illicit or traditional market, is that too much of a political issue because of the legacy in California, or is it really a matter of resources, or is it too hard to tell?
You know, I think it is kind of hard to tell, but you know, I do know at one point, I think they were promising like a 300-person task force. You know, I could be off on my number. And in reality, we got like 12 people for the entire state. And that was a couple of years ago. But again, this is a, you know, California, you can literally say it's probably three states within one. And you're going to have a dozen or so people going around trying to enforce this. It's just not happening. And then when we even bring this up to, you know, the BCC, like our governing body, or to law enforcement, I mean, they kind of look at us like, well, can you tell us where they are? And it's like, well, I mean, that's not really our job to go say, hey, there might be a trap shop over there. You know, we got other things we got to be doing. So you really wish you would see just a big commitment of them going after the illicit market and making it hurt. If you get caught, I mean, it you know, I don't know if you get put in a black book and you can't participate in a legal cannabis program or what the answer may be, but it should make them enough to say, I don't know if I really want to get involved in this, because this could really come back at me. And again, I can't go back to the taxes and the regulation of just lowering those. You're going to really entice a lot of people to move forward.
And you know, there's been that divide between the state government and the commercial regulated marketplace, because, you know, up until the state inventory tracking system was required, I believe in the beginning of 2019, there was really no way to track legal regulated cannabis. That blurred the lines for diversion and otherwise, blurred the lines between the illicit or the gray or the traditional market and the regulated market. Then there was sort of this, you know, recently at least, a combination of agencies, which in theory sent the message to the industry that the state is willing to work with them and try to make their life a little bit more simple. And then you've got this grant for the legislature, as you point out. Why doesn't the governor see that if California does it right, it could be the center of the world as a model for a commercial regulated marketplace? It already, in many ways, is the center of the world in high quality cannabis, but why not use it as the test case and the model for how to regulate and how to distribute this to consumers and make everybody at least feel comfortable about it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, one thing that we always stressed in the Marines, it was listen to the person on the ground. You might be far removed from the situation, but the people on the ground are going to paint the picture for you and develop your situational awareness and give you the best advice to go forward and to successfully execute the mission. And I don't think the powers that be are really listening to the operators on the ground of, hey, if you guys did this, this could help us out, or do that. I really think people are just looking at spreadsheets, looking at numbers, saying, well, if we do this and we tax here, we should get this amount of money back. And it's just not happening, and they're falling short, and they're really missing a great opportunity. And I'll add on top of that is the safety aspect. I mean, the people who work in the illicit market, sure, they don't have to pay taxes. They can sell cannabis at a lesser price, but they also don't have to take it to a third-party state test. So you don't even know as a consumer what you're putting in your body. And if we rewind a year and a half ago when we were going through the quote-unquote vape crisis, no person had issues with their lungs who bought cannabis from a legal state cannabis store. The only places that they were having the issues were from these what we call trap shops or the illegal dispensaries. They don't know what's in there. You have no idea what's in there and what you're putting in your body. And that's where we're seeing some of the damages. So you think from not only just a financial standpoint, but also a safety aspect, that should be priority number one for them.
No, that's very well said. And before we let you go, Brian, I just wanted to ask one question because I just was intrigued by it. And the name Hellman Valley Growers Company, where's that come from? Where's the word Hellman come from?
So in my unit, I served with 1st Marines Raider Battalion, and we served in the Helmand province in Afghanistan. And if you served there, you became part of the Helmand Valley Gun Club, and you get an HETC tattoo. So we really wanted to keep a military niche to what we were trying to do here. And we threw HVGC up on the wall, and we came up with Helmand Valley Growers Company. We're like, that sounds cool. Let's talk to the guys, make sure they're all good with it. They love the idea. They love the mission. And they're like, hey, when we get out, can we get a job with you? Which, absolutely. And so we wanted to go forward with that and, you know, kind of honor the men and women who, you know, laid it all out there in the Helmand province. You know, recently we've just left there. History will tell us what, if we made a difference or not, but at least we know some good is coming out of that that very volatile province known as Helmand. And so we're just kind of happy to carry the name and to kind of pass the story of those legends who served there.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. And it's a timely time of the year to be having this conversation. And we really applaud all the work that you're doing through a number of these organizations to help advance this conversation. And as you mentioned and characterized, this is a catch-22. And this is something that catch-22 can kind of be seen across the industry, across the relationship between the industry and the government. Just as you said, where you got to listen to the people on the ground. I think that's a valuable lesson, and something that sitting here on the 6, 7 years, 8 years, you know, on from legalization, that's something we're still not necessarily seeing, is the voice of the industry really getting to the decision makers and the policy makers and them really understanding and hearing what needs to happen in order to see the industry flourish in the way that we want. Brian, we are really thankful for your time. There's a great High Times article that came out just a couple days ago that highlighted the work that you're doing. And I would direct all of our listeners over to learn more about you and these companies, HVGcompany.com and BattleBrothersFoundation.org. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today. And we can't wait to catch up with you soon, Brian.
Yeah, Brian, thank you very much. It's our pleasure to have you, and we hope to connect with you again sometime soon.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And one last thing, if I could, if you got any veterans out there who want to get involved in what we're doing, look up the Veterans Action Council on Facebook. It's a great group of veterans all from around the country. We meet a couple of times a week to talk about the power of the plan and what's going on in legislation and how can you get out there and help. It's just a great organization. So I encourage any veteran out there who's thinking about getting into cannabis or is in cannabis, please look us up, and we'd love to welcome you to one of our meetings.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.